to the Autonicast. I'm Ed Niedermeyer. With me is my co-host, Alex Roy. Mr. Roy, how are you?
I love how serious you get when you do the intros.
This is serious business, especially when we have a guest as fascinating as the one we have today. We are lucky enough to be joined by Mr. J.R. Hildebrandt of IndyCar. Mr. Hildebrandt, how are you?
Thank you very much. Doing great, man. Thanks for having me on.
Wait, you rejected, you were accepted by MIT and walked away. Is that right?
That is accurate. Yeah, I tell people all the time, I don't really know what that says about how smart I am, but I had the shot to go, for sure.
We'd like to start with the hardball questions here on the Autonicast. You are a professional car racer, so you've got real depth of experience with vehicle dynamics and the technology that underlies it.
Right.
But as Alex just pointed out, you're also something of... Would you mind if I use the word intellectual?
I'd say that's a strong word, but we'll let you go with it today.
You are not affiliated, as Alex pointed out, with MIT, but you are involved with something called the Stanford REVS program. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah.
Could you just tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, the REVS program is a really cool part of the engineering school at Stanford that primarily focuses on the future of mobility and the automobile from a variety of different angles. The couple of programs that I work with specifically at REVS or with the REVS program at Stanford are to do with autonomous vehicle testing and research in sort of performance-based environments, sort of fringe physical environments, basically. The work that I do, the couple of teams that I work with specifically, they're all graduate students, and they're working on what are these cars capable of? What are the current limitations of autonomous vehicle technology? And kind of what can we learn about them from pushing them way off the normal radar and kind of forcing them to operate in strange situations and strange environments? So it's a really cool thing to have been a part of the last couple of years. And it's exciting for me to be involved in to gain that insight of what's really going on at the cutting edge of at a bare minimum, the physical capabilities of these cars. It's something that we don't really talk about that much, you know, so it's really cool.
You know, when you talk to engineers in the autonomous space in particular, like it seems like a lot of them are motivated by their dislike of driving rather than sort of a love of driving. So it's really interesting that you're sort of bringing what may be kind of an atypical approach to this technology compared to a lot of other folks who work in the field. So how did you get involved with this?
I got involved with Stanford in a little bit of a roundabout way. It was almost by chance, in a sense that Audi was running their self-driving RS6. They were bringing them over to the United States for the first time a couple of years ago and running at Sonoma Raceway, which is my sort of original home track. And I was asked by Road and Track magazine to come and help them sort of cover what was going on. I was, in essence, going to be the sort of human benchmark for these self-driving RS6s. What I came to find out as soon as I got there was that Stanford is running this sort of, in some ways, a little bit of a parallel program, not doing exactly the same things, but working kind of in the same area with their own Audi TTS that they call Shelly. So all of these cars had names, which I thought was awesome. The RS6s from Audi were Robbie and Bobby for the Unser brothers that ran Pikes Peak, and Shelly, Stanford's car, is after Michel Mouton. So, you know, my role there that day was to get in the car and get a ride in Audi's RS6, see what I thought of it, and then for me to go out and set a representative professional human lap time, basically, to be able to compare those cars against. So I'm standing there with the Road and Track guy and a bunch of Audi people and all this stuff, and we all just hear this, and I like look around the corner and this RS6 is literally doing like a four-wheel burnout away from the start line and like hauling the mail up the hill. Like you could hear tires screeching the entire way around the track. It came down into turn 11, which is the last corner where we were standing by the pit lane. I mean, I was watching it sitting there thinking like, I am not going to break that late the first time I go out on track. It was a little bit of a wake-up call, like, this is not a joke. Like, they are not screwing around, at least in terms of how hard the car is driving. Like, it was visually evident that it was at its limit, you know, in terms of, like, its capability for outright braking, outright cornering, outright acceleration. So anyway, so I get out and get a ride around in the lap, and after a couple of corners, you know, I'm applying the same mentality that I would if I'm in the passenger seat with a person. You know, what are they doing? How are they doing this? How are they putting together their racing line? You know, all of these things. It was interesting to me with that experience first, just that I very quickly felt totally comfortable. I could tell what the car was doing. We came in, you know, I've got sort of a microphone in my face wanting to know what I thought about the whole thing. And I just explained what I thought the car was doing. I explained how I thought the car was putting together its lap. I thought that it probably didn't account for elevation change. I felt like it's prioritizing, you know, straight line braking, straight line acceleration, but I submitted that maybe it wasn't aware of its own weight transfer and some things like that. The professor who leads the REVS program at Stanford, Chris Gerdes, he was standing there and he just said, "Holy shit, like you just reverse engineered what this thing is doing, like in a lap." I think a handful of us together, myself and Chris and some other people were involved in the conversation with Stanford to recognize what value there might be for having a high-performing human sort of in the loop of AV development and trying to help both in terms of creating, you know, meaningful data in terms of like what does a human who's operating at a really high level do and how do they do it and what does that produce? But then also being able to give quality feedback in terms of what are the human processes for all of these things? What do I think the car is doing differently than what I'm doing? What if that is better? What if that's worse? So I guess that's sort of the long explanation of how I got involved with Stanford. But that also, you know, bleeds into a little bit of what I do with those programs there as well.
What would you say sort of the biggest strength and maybe the biggest weaknesses of the systems as they are right now, sort of relative to a high-performing human?
The things that really stand out as sort of obvious things that the cars do particularly well and where the sort of focus is in terms of making them better. Shelly, the track car, is a good example of this. It is insanely good at knowing exactly where it is on the track, knowing exactly what it's doing. It generates its own lap. It generates its own racing line. It generates its own input strategy for running on that racing line. It generates its own priorities for how it's going to approach different corners. But very unlike a human, it doesn't adapt to feeling, finding, experiencing once it gets out on track. It's been interesting working with Shelley because it's made me realize how much as a human I rely on being able to do that. So I don't have nearly the database to work from that Shelley does when I first go on the track. Even if I've got a ton of laps on that track, like I don't know exactly where the car is. I don't know exactly how much brake pressure I'm applying. It's kind of this constant iterative adaptive feedback loop that you're putting yourself into. The way that I get faster within that loop is by being able to recognize for myself, based on feeling most of the time, if I'm doing something different than the last time, if I'm making kind of these evolutionary small mutations to how I'm making inputs into a corner or the line that I'm choosing, which of those things is better or worse lap to lap, and then trying to compile all the best versions of each corner to put together a whole lap. Shelley really doesn't do that almost at all. And yet, because she has so much information to work from and has been developed so well to prioritize that information adequately, is within 1% basically of my outright capability. So it's interesting just in that, from that perspective alone, while the end lap time is very similar, the mechanisms to getting to that end lap time and the processes involved in that are in some ways very different. Part of the things that we're working on is trying to understand how can we create kind of a sense of better or worse so that the car can learn from itself. It's been really interesting both from a human perspective and from a computer machine perspective to learn about, you know, where the push and pull is.
JR, in the real world, you've got these guys at Roborace who want to hold a race with autonomous race cars. So I understand that, you know, things like Shelley can get around a track within, you know, milliseconds of a human or maybe faster, but that's alone without other vehicles on the course.
Right.
How are they going to teach the racecraft? Because racecraft can barely be taught. It's, you know, instinctual among humans.
Yeah.
And it would seem to be more art than science.
This gets to a similar sort of thread in terms of, can these machines be taught to learn on their own, basically based on their own experience? We talked a lot about that in terms of getting Shelley just to be able to run a better lap. I think the same, frankly, holds true for any variety of other situations with AVs, which include the idea of AVs racing against each other, that if they're always reliant upon some baseline level of programming in order to make decisions, then it'll never seem like it's human, you know, because in the example of racecraft at a racetrack, like, you're hardly ever executing a pass that is exactly how you thought it was going to end up. You often have to be super opportunistic just all of a sudden in a moment. There's like an emotional, psychological element of how much is the guy that you're trying to get around going to be committing to keeping you behind him? What are the tools that are in his toolbox to do that? You look at the greats. You look at, I mean, Senna is the obvious example. A lot of the passes that he made on people were just sheerly out of like intimidation, you know? How does that translate to an autonomous vehicle? It's where we get into a larger conversation of those are the things that humans actually do incredibly well, is adapting to a split second change in their environment. And is there a way that we can add a layer of sort of human-like intuition to dealing with those kinds of situations on top of the things that the AVs already do really well, which is repetitive tasks and these cars that are not being developed in any way, shape, or form to exist on public roads? They are doing things that absolutely are teaching us valuable lessons for plenty of public road situations that I think as an enthusiast, they're teaching us things that make me feel like there's going to be AVs at some point that I'm really going to enjoy being in. You know what I mean? That. Yeah. Because that's something that, like, I frankly, for me personally, I don't see a lot of. Like, I sort of see a lot of things to me that are like, well, that looks like the ride quality in that thing is going to be garbage. Or, you know, it's just a driverless version of some service that already exists or whatever. Like, please, somebody show me something that I can get excited about. You know, that's where a lot of this stuff comes into play. And a part of it is because it's driven by people who are enthusiasts, who believe in the future of the automobile industry as being kind of like probably a mixed bag of stuff, but that certainly involves AVs to a high degree and want to make that experience as great as it can be, not just a minimally viable thing, you know?
And just in terms of safety, I mean, we've seen a lot. A couple of years ago, Waymo had this problem, and I think it seems like Cruise maybe is having issues with this now, where because, you know, they have such a safety first approach to these systems when they're developing them, these test vehicles often drive incredibly conservatively, and that actually can create problems for the humans, right? Where all of a sudden this car is not driving the way a human would because it is so conservative. So in some respects, right, having a car be able to drive more aggressively will in theory make it more human-like, which will in turn allow it to sort of work in mixed traffic better, right?
Just like anything, it's about raising the sort of ceiling of potential of the cars and what they're capable of doing, right? So the more capable the car is in more sort of ways, the better everything is going to end up being and the more it can exist in a wider variety of environments. Just to speak on the safety thing, because it's like a touchy subject for me, I think we've gotten into like a really weird place in terms of the conversation around AVs just in the media generally from that perspective, which is that by and large, the discussion around the benefit of AVs is that they remove the human error factor, basically, right? That we will see this, you know, reduction in traffic deaths and all this kind of stuff. That's sort of the line that a lot of the industry is towing as well, like that's why we should be caring about this. That's not the right rhetoric for why we should care about AVs. We should care about AVs because they make things more convenient, or they make things more accessible, or they give us more time, or whatever. Like there's plenty of other things that I think for every person will make AVs appealing in at least basic circumstances without them needing to be safer in order to do that. But given that that's not the way that a lot of this is being talked about by the industry and then by the media kind of covering the industry, the idea that we now have these like fleets of AVs that for all intents and purposes appear as though they are not safe, certainly not as safe as they are expected to eventually be, it's just a lot of mixed signals that I frankly don't understand. I understand the necessity to be early movers in all of these places, but I think that there needs to be, coming from the industry, coming from the people that really care about this and depend on it, there needs to be a clearer set of guidelines or a clearer definition for why are we actually pushing so hard to do all of this? And as end consumers, what are we supposed to be looking forward to? The fleet-based thing all by itself is just kind of like, well, why? Like, why would I care? If the only difference is that there's going to be a driver in the car or not, it had better be appreciably cheaper or more convenient or more accessible or something for me to want that or for me to choose that over just having somebody come pick me up if I've got the option. You know what I mean? So it's difficult to kind of work out the signal through the noise of all that's going on here.
Why would you ever get into a car, even if it was cheaper, unless it was appreciably safer than you would be driving? I mean, we get into taxis every day with drivers with unknown safety records. But I don't see why someone would get into a car that's as safe as a human, even if it was free.
There's two things that are involved in that discussion. One is, at least if I get in a taxi or a Lyft or an Uber that has a person driving it, especially a Lyft and an Uber, frankly, because it's like their car, it's that person's personal vehicle, I just have the assumption that that person is looking out for themselves and their car, at least. That in turn is them looking out for me as their passenger. That's a piece of like this kind of AV discussion as a ride hailing service, particularly, that doesn't appear to be well worked out in terms of like, I think that we're overlooking how much people trust another human to look out for them, basically. And that if an AV is not clearly going to do that for its passenger first and foremost, why would you choose that over just getting a ride with another human? The other part of it is just with, you know, the potential for AV, the potential to be driven autonomously places. I think we all highly underestimate how goddamn convenient just having your own car and being able to go get in it whenever you want and go wherever you want, like on a moment's notice, actually is. You know what I mean? Like, I get it for being in downtown Manhattan, but that's not the fair majority of people in the United States either.
Yeah. One of the other sort of angles that gets talked about a lot from people who work at the companies who are doing this autonomous vehicle development, it's sort of this idea that, you know, cars aren't very well utilized, right? They sit 90% of the time or 95% of the time. And that's like a problem on a social level. But on an individual level, right, like that's exactly what it's supposed to do. It's supposed to be there waiting for you so that it's ready to go whenever you need it. And in order to have that in an autonomous vehicle, right, you need to have, instead of having vehicles parked, you know, at your house or at your work or whatever, they're actually going to be circling on the road. So to have that functionality of like anytime you need a ride on demand, it will just be there. You need to have a lot of vehicles potentially with no occupants, making congestion much, much worse. So it definitely does seem like there's a little bit of a mismatch.
It's not a matter of does some version of that make a lot of sense in certain environments. I'm positive that it does. But, you know, we were just at the LA Auto Show and I found myself constantly overhearing conversations where people are just ready to adopt this nobody drives their car ever and every car on the road is autonomous and that would fix everything kind of mentality. And I kind of find myself sitting there like, that is going to be like a mobility apocalypse, not a mobility utopia, if that's actually what happens. So I think that it's important that, you know, we do have these conversations and that weird development off in left field is going on and that enthusiasts are a part of that conversation, not only to look out for our own privileges and position within the automotive industry, but to make sure that these things are actually really good. You know, like if we're going to have all these services, we're spending all this money getting to level 5, let's make sure that they're great. Let's make sure that that experience is awesome. Let's make sure that it's human. There's like a human design element to it. That in the end is like why we like driving anyway, you know?
you wrote a really interesting thing on Medium, sort of comparing cars and guns, which it's a comparison that has been coming up a lot more recently. I think as people have started to talk about the potential for banning human driving, could you like summarize sort of what your thoughts or your argument, if you have a specific one, with this comparison is? Why did you make it? What were you trying to get at?
So I'm not a gun owner. I don't see myself being a gun owner. Like it's a right I don't use. I'm not somebody who has any intention really of needing to use my right to bear arms. I was thinking about this discussion that like there appear to be plenty of people that seem okay with the idea that they would, that like our driving privileges would just get revoked. Maybe that's geofence. Like it's depending on where you live. Maybe it makes sense for everybody to have their driver's license, like once AVs get to the point that, or even in an effort to help AVs get to the point that they are safer than humans, like just get rid of all the humans. Like that's the obvious answer. And so I realized like how fired up I got about that, like that I would just fight like tooth and nail to retain my driving privileges. And that to me, that was not, it's not because I feel like I'm owed them. It's because it's a fundamental part of my personal human experience on a day-to-day basis. I like driving a car. I feel like I'm responsible and accountable, and I don't get into accidents. I don't get tickets. I do things well. I drive probably more assertively than like your average person or whatever, but it's something that I really care about. And it made me think to the contrary, like, well, without that context, if you told me that everybody in Colorado just like wasn't going to be allowed to have a gun, what impact does that have on me specifically relative to like this gun control debate? Because there are people who similarly think that just like we should just ban guns, like people should not be allowed to own guns. That would like solve our gun death, firearm injury problem. Anyway, it was just sort of this idea that thinking about gun control in the terms of how I would feel about my driving privileges being revoked, which are not protected by law, which are not in the Constitution, which, you know, whatever, it made me rethink the premise of the gun control debate. And to me, it was an important distinction just for me personally in thinking about gun control to realize that really this is not just about protecting a constitutional right. It is about finding some middle ground whereby the people that do really care about this can be allowed to be responsible gun owners, and where it's protected as like a freedom that we have as humans, as a choice that we have as humans. Because that to me is, in the end, the biggest issue at hand when we talk about people's driving privileges getting revoked, is that maybe that would be more safe, but it's a choice that we are currently afforded, and it's not something that we should just relinquish freely if only to retain that choice.
Would you say that there is a war on driving?
I don't know that I would say that there is an existing war on driving. One of my points in the article was sort of taking like the infinite monkey theorem as an example, like that the infinite monkey theorem states that if you left a monkey to punch random keys on a typewriter for an infinite amount of time, that it would eventually produce the full works of William Shakespeare. So basically that like, if given like infinite possible futures, like anything could happen. But among infinite futures, there are plenty of them where people are banned from driving. And that just with that as a feasible possible outcome, those of us that do care about it might consider preparing for a war on driving. But just like I wish that the NRA was doing better in the gun control debate, would I wish that people that cared about their rights to bear firearms were doing? I think that a part of the strategy for those of us who care about driving, it has to be to really look deep down inside and think about what about this are we willing to give up, or what about this are we willing to compromise on in order to retain the things that we care about, that we actually care about in terms of maintaining our driving privileges. Like, would I be okay with having to do a yearly, highly intensive drive, you know, in-car driver's test? That would be more of a pain in the ass, even for me, than it currently is to not have to do that all the time. But would I be willing to do that and be willing to accept that that's going to mean that there are going to be a bunch of people that don't retain their driver's licenses just so that I can retain my driver's license? Maybe. Would I be willing to do that if I had slightly more freedom and had slightly more flexibility in terms of how I could drive and what my speed limits were on the freeway or like, you know, things like that? Personally, absolutely, I would do that. So there's some of these things that I think as passionate drivers, I don't think it would be a bad idea for us to be thinking about how to get ahead of some of these conversations and be sort of preparing a narrative of our own for why this matters.
So if I was going to launch the Human Driving Association, which would be, say, the NRA of human driving, would you join that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Would you pay $50 a year to protect your privileges?
Am I a board? Are you making me a board member, or am I just like a member? Or like, well, you know, I don't. Yeah, yes, I would pay $50 a year for that.
Does that mean that people who want to protect their driving privileges in the future should aggressively embrace semi-autonomy in order to prevent full autonomy from removing their privileges?
It's an interesting point. I mean,
make you deal with the devil to prevent the takeover. You know,
I am a pro-choice mobility future believer.
So you're pro-choice in the war on driving?
Yes. Like I think that like it probably makes sense. I'm not opposed to the idea of there being certain environments where like eventually people aren't allowed to drive. Or that you have to have like some insane set of credentials to be able to drive in certain environments or certain areas or whatever. Like, I guess that just as a specific thing doesn't bother me. But I think that there needs to be representation in that certainly national conversation around how that's developed to arrive at a solution that is actually better for everybody rather than just like more effing boring for everybody. You know what I mean? And so I think that it's less about, to your point, making a deal with the devil or deciding like, you know, among different evils, you know, among different non-manual, non-fully manual driving modes. It's about being able to have some integration and representation into that discussion at an industry level, at a government level, at a city planning level. I think that people mistake enthusiasts a lot of times for people that like want to just be driving around like cars that don't qualify for emission standards or something, you know? And it's kind of like, no, we actually just really enjoy the act of being in control of our own mobility devices, whether that be motorcycles or old cars or new cars or semi-autonomous cars or fully autonomous cars. You know what I mean? And so I think that that's an important and currently sort of overlooked viewpoint as these different sort of processes and projects and technologies get taken on.
Absolutely. Well, that is this is fascinating stuff. I, for one, already regret our decision to move to half-hour-long episodes here at the Autonicast because I really want to keep talking about this stuff, but we do have to go, and we'll have to have you back to talk about this stuff more. Hopefully, there'll be some developments that give us a little bit of optimism about moving in this direction that you're describing, because I certainly agree with you that this is a really important aspect to consider, and it's really not being considered very well. JR, where can people sort of stay in touch with you? I mentioned Medium, Twitter maybe. I'll let people know because I think you're a really important voice for people to be listening to.
I've enjoyed being on with you guys for sure. Twitter is kind of like my ground for conversation around this kind of stuff. I do have a Medium page that I can't say I use particularly often, but at JR Hildebrand on Twitter is kind of the best place to find me. And you know, I look forward to continuing the discussion wherever it goes.
Yeah, absolutely. Mr. Roy, where can people find you?
Well, I'm losing my voice, so you can find me on Twitter. Actually, on all platforms at AlexRoy144. And I occasionally answer hate mail. It's great.
I'm on Twitter at Tweetermeyer. We are always at autonicast.com. Also on Twitter at the Autonicast. JR Hildebrand, thank you again so much for taking the time to speak with us. And we look forward to discussing the always interesting future of mobility with you again sometime.
Thanks, guys.
And let's not forget to shout out our co-host who's not with us in this episode, Kirsten Korosek, who is on all platforms, KirstenKorosek.
That's right. Nicely done. Thanks, fellas.
Thank you.